Welcome to the Infotagem podcast, focused on the work of the Joint Select Committee on the Draft Online Safety Bill. I'm Damien Collins, the host of this podcast, and also the chair of the Joint Committee. In this show, we'll be focused on the public evidence session held by the committee on Thursday, the 23rd of September. On that occasion, the committee heard from William Perrin, trustee at Carnegie Trust UK, Dr. Adina Harbinger, senior lecturer in media and privacy law at Aston University, Professor Sonia Livingston, a professor of social psychology at the London School of Economics, Department of Media and Communications, and Professor Claire McGlynn, professor of law at University of Durham. Following that panel, we also spoke with Jimmy Wales, the founder of Wikipedia, and finally, Elizabeth Denham, CBE, the Information Commissioner for the UK, and her colleague, the Executive Director of the Information Commission, Stephen Bonner. But first up, we'll hear from Debbie Abrahams, MP, as she questions Will Perrin about why a strong duty of care is central to the work of the Online Safety Bill.
Thank you. I wonder if I could just pick up on Mr. Perrin's comments just now about the duty of care. Why do you think it hasn't been included in the draft bill? What are both the pros and the cons of having a statutory duty for providers in terms of a duty of care?
It's hard to know why the government hasn't gone for an overarching duty, so, and I can only guess, but I think it is because, as I hinted, the government regards it wants to take care quite rightly not to overregulate the whole of the internet and the whole of social media, and I think that's a good objective. And so they've gone to the other end of the spectrum and said, hey, okay, here are two areas that we care about a great deal: illegality and harms to children. Everyone would agree with that. Is when we care about a bit less, harms to adults, very, very weak duty. And so I've put those three duties in. But they're duties towards particular types of content in the main, not in the whole. And so then there's a huge infrastructure off the back of that then to work out what those types of content are, which is complex, and what the risks are. We think the benefit of an overarching duty is that it is very durable and very long term. If we go back to the Health and Safety at Work Act, that duty has been around since 1974. The duty with respect to safety on land was introduced by Viscount Kilmure in, I think, 1956, the great Nuremberg prosecutor, and that duty still persists but doesn't have a regulator. So we think there is this durability in these duties, which is particularly important at a time of accelerated change and in this industry, above all others. And in such a duty, one needs to have confidence in the regulator's capability to determine what is harmful and to keep up with research, as Professor Livingston was doing, but also to ensure that companies are staying in touch with what is harmful. So this general sense of taking reasonable steps to prevent reasonably foreseeable harms is a very powerful tool, mm-hmm. especially against companies at this scale of operation, where we can't always know from the outside the extent that they do perceive risks to their customers. And the reporting in the Wall Street Journal recently has been very instrumental on that.
Next, we hear from Professor Claire McGlynn as she explains to John Nicholson MP about cyber flashing and why this is an increasingly aggressive and endemic form of behaviour online.
Professor McGlynn, can I start with you, and can we return to those gaping holes in the legislation which you mentioned right at the start? And one of those gaping holes appears to be cyber flashing. A lot of people tune in and listen to these sessions and will have no idea what cyber flashing is. Could you explain to us what it is, please?
So cyber flashing, I think if we think of it as the online equivalent of physical flashing, person in the street, and what it is the sending of unsolicited penis images to someone else without their consent. We've seen this on the rise in recent years because of the advancing of technology with airdrop, for example. So you can be on public transport, and if your airdrop is open, someone can send you that unsolicited penis image and it can come up on your phone without you knowing. But it's also very prevalent in all social media, online apps, etc. Some of the data shows particularly young women being affected. The Ofsted review about sexual abuse in schools saw a phenomenal amount of young girls having to deal with being sent unsolicited penis images on a regular basis.
Yeah, we know that nearly half of women aged between 18 and 24 have received these images.
Yes.
I mean, who are the people who send these images? You know, in the olden days, the person you have in mind as a flasher is the proverbial dirty old man with the, you know, with the raincoat. Mm. I mean, who are the people who do it today? Who are these? All these folk who send images to 18 to 24-year-olds?
Your average, everyday person, well, mostly men, are sending images. And this is where the technology changes why abuse is happening. So you're right that physical flashing is associated with particular types of person. But you've got people are sending these images to cause direct distress and harm, because they want to, for sexual gratification, but a large amount, for ostensibly humour, but a large amount of it is a kind of, you know, male bonding amongst their peers.
Now, Lord Stephen Gilbert asked Professor McGlynn about how the law can be clarified and changed to deal with this problem, and in particular in response to the recent report of the Law Commission reviewing communications offences.
Have you seen work on how existing law may be codified and clarified so that it undoubtedly deals with much of this content, and what additional measures might be passed into law? Sorry, so it's a bunch of things, but I thought it was easier to put them all together.
Let me start. First of all, with the criminal law, you're absolutely right that there are proposals from the Law Commission that would deal with some of this online communications and harassment, and that would bring that up to date. There are then a number of other sorts of offences that could be introduced. We've talked about cyber flashing. We could talk about deep fakes. There is also another review of all intimate image abuse offences, which are very much needed. I might just add, whilst I have the opportunity, we could also, if we're talking about pornography, for example, a criminal offence that if you make a false representation that you have the consent of someone when you upload an image, we could make that a criminal offence to try and reduce the swathes of non-consensual material on porn companies, and also on porn companies to make them have the consent of individuals. So there is that raft of criminal law. Yes, the criminal law is often not easily kept up to date, although that is a political issue. I think we could be more swift in updating the criminal law. In terms of then the follow-on design of regulation,
just quickly on that. Do you agree that really the benefit of that is not about criminalising individuals, but putting a clear duty on the platforms to take this stuff down?
Well, I think it's both. I think it's both. It's a clear duty on individuals. This is a criminal offence. This is wrong. I think it is also an important message to victims, because it's about, we recognise your harm. We understand what's happened to you. And in the context of this bill, it's about making clear what is illegal, and therefore that the companies must do.
Susan Webb MP asked the witnesses if the Online Safety Bill will deliver on its priorities, and in particular, we'll hear from Will Perrin, Adina Harbinger and Professor McGlynn on how to strike the balance between freedom of speech and protecting users from harm.
Just to follow up on that, without going back and all over the detail, but bearing in mind what you said, do you think this Online Harms Bill is the right vehicle to deliver exactly what you believe should be the success of that bill?
At this stage in its evolution, it's in a good, strong position. It does need some changes, though, as we all agree, in order particularly, and I agree with my colleague here, to make sure that the right balance of human rights around speech are there and the role of the Secretary of State is put in its appropriate place.
Thank you. I think in the current form, it will not deliver on the aims and objectives, and I do agree with the aims and objectives set out by the government and in the bill. So I think that the bill needs to go through very broad scrutiny, as it does, and it will need to go through a great number of amendments regarding, for example, legal but harmful content, democratic journalistic content, redefining some of the obligations and duties of the platform's enforcement mechanisms, and everything that we have talked about. So I think quite a significant change is required.
Yeah, not yet. And on that, I think, if I can just say, let's not let these porn companies go under the radar. They need to be included, even if they then remove their user-generated functions. And then the second point is, I would just make the point about freedom and safety. Women's freedom of speech is currently constrained because of the amount of online abuse. So we need the safety in order to give us the freedom. So they're not a dichotomy in that sense.
Here, I questioned Jimmy Wales of Wikipedia about its content moderation policies, and in particular, how it moderates things like anti-vax disinformation.
This morning, I thought I'd have a quick check on Wikipedia to see what it said about COVID-19 vaccine. Mm. And there's a very well put together section on that describing the evolution providers and all the rest of it. And I thought a very good and very helpful piece on discussing misinformation about the vaccine and the fact there's a lot of misinformation out there. What there wasn't on the Wikipedia page, though, was misinformation about the vaccine itself. It's clearly being very well policed, very well regulated. There must be attempts all of the time to insert anti-vaccine conspiracy theories into it. So I was just interested with that. Is that an effective example of community moderation, or is this Wikipedia itself deciding it's going to make a decision on COVID-19 vaccines and the sort of information it will make available?
That's a fantastic question, and it's a great sort of opening for one of the things I think is really important for us to remember as we think about these issues. We often have a model in mind of content regulation, content moderation, which I sort of would refer to as the lord and the serfs. In other words, the companies run the platforms, the users do whatever the hell they want to do, and the platforms try to keep them under control or to moderate. And our model is completely different. The Wikimedia Foundation, which is the nonprofit charity that runs and operates Wikipedia, has almost nothing to do with that. There's very, very little, very rare cases where we get involved, which really has more to do with specific safety issues and things like that. But we have a community that is incredibly fierce about regulating that type of misinformation. And that's by design. From the very beginning, from the very early days of Wikipedia, there's been this commitment to designing a social system that drives towards truth and drives away from misinformation, disinformation. It is imperfect. I mean, we've all seen stories of errors in Wikipedia, and sometimes those errors persist for longer than we would like. But in general, it's a very different approach. And in fact, we're very proud of our work on COVID-19 and coronavirus across many, many languages around the world. And that's really down to a group of volunteers, largely in English Wikipedia. It's a group called Wiki Project Medicine. They're quite a fearsome group. They're very, very strict.
Now we hear from Baroness Beben-Kidron, who asked Jimmy Wales whether big platforms are failing to protect their users time and again, and whether it's a failure of their business model.
Can I ask you, the tough question is, if they're endlessly failing, you know, is it a good business model? You know, is there something more profound to ask there?
I have said to people at Facebook that if the general public becomes convinced that you're leading to the destruction of Western civilization, that's probably not good for your business in the long run. I hope I'm right when I say that. and I think they do sense that. I'm not, you know, privy to anything in particular that goes on there, but I think a lot of people at these companies do understand. Whether they're willing and able to actually do something about it is a whole other question, but I think they do understand that there is a real problem, that if you're amplifying misinformation and you're, you know, not creating an experience, like what you really want, or what I think you want as any kind of a responsible company, and I'm talking about making any kind of product, is to not be big tobacco, right? You want to say, I think my customers' lives are improved on that by the services that I offer. So for a service that offers community connectivity, family and friends, news information, you want to say, actually, I believe that when people come on the service, their lives are made meaningfully better in the long run. And if you don't have that, I think you've got to really question whether you should change your thinking and change your model.
Finally, I wanted to ask Elizabeth Denham whether she felt Ofcom, as the regulator, would have sufficient powers to audit the big tech companies, powers equivalent to the powers the Information Commissioner has to audit their data protection policies.
It would strike me that the investigatory powers for the regulator are really important, because we've seen a system so far where the social media companies largely self-report on what they do. And even in Germany, where there's content legislation, we rely on self-reporting. And that if the regulator doesn't have the power to go in and gather data and information as part of an investigation, then it won't be able to properly hold them to account, particularly on systems failures. Content failures are easy to see because you're aware of a piece of content, but the systems failures that allow that content to spread are harder to see. I mean, what do you think are the practical challenges in trying to use those enforcement powers against companies like Facebook and Google?
I think that the information gathering powers that are in the draft bill for Ofcom are important, but I think they also need to be bolstered by audit powers for the regulator to be able to look under the bonnet. I think that's really important. And I'll use an example from our own experience with the age-appropriate design code. And as you know, this is a world-leading code that is starting to change the systems and the design and the behavior of some of the world's largest companies, not just in the UK, but internationally. So we've seen some really good changes. We are carrying out a series of audits on some of the highest risk processing on the big platforms. And because we have the power to audit, then we can actually see what's going on under the hood, under the bonnet. So I think audit powers are really important. Strong information gathering is important. Those transparency reports, in a way, is like a consumer commitment to how content issues and takedown is going to be actually supported by the company. So all of these things together, but I would like to see some stronger powers of compulsory audits.
So your reading of the bill is that the auditing powers that Ofcom would have are not as strong as the powers that you have in legislation today?
Absolutely.
I'm now joined by my colleague on the committee, Dean Russell MP, to get his impressions of the evidence we've heard so far.
So we're joined now by my committee colleague, Dean Russell. Dean, what did you make of the evidence session we had with Jimmy Wells from Wikipedia in particular? It's interesting to hear a very different sort of network and one that's got its own quite specific standards about content moderation.
Well, I thought it was really fascinating, actually. I think when you listen to Jimmy, you know, and you think of the journey that they've been on as Wikipedia, in a way, they were one of the first sort of mature content, not in an adult sense, but in a world of the Wild West of the web, how many years ago, they were one of the first that really tried to create some sort of system where there's proof of content and having references and making sure the content was verifiable and turning it into an encyclopedia. So it was interesting listening to his take that, in my mind, it was almost he was saying it wasn't user-generated because it was being validated, whereas actually he was seemingly saying that other social media sites were much more user-generated and actually much more fast-paced. And it was interesting hearing his distinction.
But they clearly have a consistent standard based around, obviously, their volunteers working on the site, moderating the site. But they've got quite clear standards in terms of having to back up what people say, provide evidence. And obviously, that's very different from the way companies like Facebook and Twitter moderate content on their platforms.
Absolutely. And I think the other thing that was really interesting on that point was how much it's involves people, you know, and actual volunteers doing that editing and that verification. Whereas, of course, what we're hearing and seeing from Facebook and Twitter is that there's an awful lot of AI and algorithms and technology and so on going into place, looking at that content and making a decision on behalf of people. Whereas clearly in Wikipedia's case, they have real people verifying it. And so those systems and stock checks and processes are human driven, even though the output is on the screen. Whereas for the other platforms, it's very much technology first, it seems.
Absolutely. And I thought we had a very interesting discussion with the Information Commissioner, Elizabeth Denham, on that interface between content and the tech that drives that content. And in particular, the use of inferred data, which she said she regards as personal data, which helps drive the algorithms. It determines what people get to see. And so you've got to look at both the data that underpins that as well as what is actually being shared.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it's fascinating, isn't it, if you think about it. A lot of the work that's been going through for GDPR has been email, which is very much a transactional one way almost, but you receive it and then you respond. Whereas with social media, it's much more fast-paced. And in a way, you can receive lots of content and still not actively reply to it, but you'll still engage with it. And so I think the her take on systems was really important. I was taken aback a little bit on the conversation, though, about consent. I asked her a question right at the end about what was her take on consent with regards the bill. And I think it was interesting to hear that she hadn't really delved into that much in terms of her thinking. It's not a criticism of what she'd been doing, but actually a lot of this is about consent in my mind, in a different way from email, but very much about what is it you're happy to receive when you're looking at adults in particular. And so it'd be interesting in the bill how that progresses when we interview other witnesses.
And this is something that obviously you've spent quite a lot of time thinking about as well. Obviously, you've been very actively involved in Parliament on the whole question of age verification. Mm-hmm. Now, where do you think that sits within this at the moment? What are your views on the bill as it stands on age verification, or the absence of it, effectively?
Absolutely. I mean, I think where I'm at the moment is that I think we need to have a really good look at why and where it would be, actually. For me, age verification is really important. I'm the chair of the APPG on digital ID. And whilst that isn't age verification specifically, it is about making sure you've got the technology in place, in part, to do those sorts of things. And my slight concern is if you don't know whether the child is a child, how can you then make sure that they're not receiving the content that they shouldn't be receiving? So I think it's important that we delve into that more as we move forward. But we know from our fantastic other panellists committee members that there's an awful lot of great technology out there. So how do we employ that, I suppose, if we're going to look at that moving forward?
And that's right, because it's interesting to know to what extent do the companies actually know someone is underage or not. And when we had that discussion about, in particular, unsolicited sort of pornographic images and effects, sort of images of genitalia being sent to sort of young girls in particular, which I think from the, you know, everyone's invited sort of campaign, you can see has become sadly for many, many young people, a regular part of their life.
Yeah, it's sickening, really, isn't it? And I think, you know, the more you look at this, the more you realise as well, technology is pervasive across all ages now. You know, when I was younger, mobile phones didn't even exist, you know, at least not unless there were satellite phones with big cases. Whereas now children, toddlers even have their own phones. And so the access to this sort of content is there. It's just about whether parents in some instances know that whether their kids are actually seeing it. So I think age verification comes into that. But also I think there's a really important part about, you know, checking to see whether actually should kids be looking at those sorts of platforms, and are the platforms making sure kids aren't when it's under the age that they say that their terms and conditions are following.
Absolutely. And I think, I thought Claire McGlynn was very, very strong on this in the evidence she gave to the committee. And it's a fair question to say, you know, can a 14-year-old girl ever be considered to have consented to receiving sort of, you know, sexualized images, whether that was part of the conversation or not. In other areas of the law, you would say, well, if you're, you know, under the age of consent, you, by its very nature, you can't give consent.
Yeah. You're 100% right. And I think that's part of this, isn't it? It's how do you create proper parity between real life and virtual life? And the idea that a 14-year-old girl should be able to be, should even be comprehending having to worry about receiving this sort of content is just simply wrong. And you wouldn't, if you had someone carrying a poster of this stuff down the street, quite rightly the police would arrest them. The question is, how do we make sure that that same protection is in place for children online or when they've got their phone on the bus or whatever? But that's where the complexity comes, because it's not just a technology thing, is it? It's a rules, regulations process, and also how do you employ the law online?
Well, I think that's a really key point. I think that's already emerging as quite a strong theme in the work we've done so far. I think many people are amazed at how there are gaps in the law, that things that are known to be offences offline are not designated as offensive or offences on digital media. And I think lots of people ask the question, well, why is that not the case?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the challenge in a way, though, I think was highlighted in our very first witness a few weeks ago, when he was making the point that in Washington, they were staying up overnight to do watch parties of us doing the committee because this was brand new in the world. You know, we're the first country to really be doing this, I believe. And so I think it's something that everyone agrees is needed. It's just about what form does it take? And I think when you look at the range of the witnesses we've had on the committee, look at the evidence that's been sent in, it's incredibly complex. And so you can sort of understand why no government has wanted to grapple it before. But at the same time, we're at a point now where we have to grapple it because, you know, we can't keep going down this awful rabbit hole of awful content for more generations to come.
Obviously, we're very focused on all of this with the work of the Joint Committee. But I mean, as a constituency member of Parliament and a relatively new member of Parliament as well, I mean, how do you think this issue sits with people in your constituency?
Well, I think that on the whole, I would say that they agree that it's absolutely needed. The question is, what it looks like. You know, I do have conversations with people very worried about the impact on civil liberties and freedom of speech. And then similarly, other people, and very understandably myself included, very worried about their kids and about, you know, abusive content and the impact of that on footballers through to society, through to all the things we've talked about. So I think there's a very real need for this actually in society, and I think my constituents, from my view, would agree with that. Again, it just puts the weight on our shoulders as a committee to make sure that we're scrutinising the right way. And so far, I feel very pleased, that especially under your chairmanship, that we're really looking under every rock to make sure that we're getting this right.
Yeah, I think it is really important to get it right. And I think from looking at things people speak to me about as a member of Parliament is, I think there are increasing numbers of people that have been directly affected by these issues, that have got, you know, concerned about images their children have seen or might see. They're concerned about, they may have been victims of scams online, and or they're very concerned about the level of racial abuse that exists on the internet and seems to be growing. And many people themselves are victims of harmful content in that way. And I think what they can't understand is why more isn't being done about it. Why is it we can't get the tech companies to do more to stop this? And I think that's, it's become something that people have got their own personal experience of now and personal perspective on.
Absolutely. And I think the difficulty, isn't it, is that, you know, this is probably the first time in history where you've had a platform for communications which is so pervasive, which everybody agrees that this content shouldn't be on there. I think the vast majority of people see the need why this, you know, legislation and regulations need to come in. But they are still using the platforms that are sharing this content. You know, the Facebooks and the Twitters who are, you know, we know that there's abusive content on there, but also it's a place that people are speaking to their families. Mm. They're keeping, especially during lockdown, they were keeping in touch with families across the country or across the world. So you've got this very weird balance of people wanting to have very real relationships remotely, often written or sharing photos or using the live technologies, matched with the fact that it also has this awful risk of abusive content, the awful risk of the harms that it can do to society as well. And I think that's part of the challenge here, is that there's the algorithms in terms of promoting content and awful, harmful, abusive content. However, it's also a platform where people have got very real relationships invested in continuing those.
And that's right. And I think it's really clear as well that we've, you know, it's important that the bill addresses both harmful content that people post, but the role of the tech companies in sharing that content, that it's not a question of you only see content from people that, you know, you follow have immediately posted it. You see a whole range of content which you're targeted with by the platforms, and that active role they play is, you know, not just harmful in the wrong circumstances, but potentially more harmful than the fact that the content was posted in the first place.
Absolutely. And I think the other challenge to it as well is the algorithms that are promoting the content, especially the harmful content, is promoting it to people that might also not just be harmed, but also people who might want to agree with it and share it further. And so you've got an issue now where you've got tribes almost being created around the world that previously those people may not have connected. And so therefore actually would have dissipated and disappeared, because it might have been someone in a pub shouting with their mates, and then it's sort of been forgotten at the end of a Friday night. Now it's permanently there, and other people around the world can pick it up and perhaps go, well, we agree with you. We think that's a, you know, the rest of society would go, that's awful, you know, awfully harmful and awfully abusive. For those people might go, well, actually, you know what? That person over there agrees with me. And so in a way, not only is it promoting the content and putting it in people's faces, it's also connecting people who might have those views. And that's the danger of it, in a way, that it goes further than it just being an algorithm. It's actually affecting society.
Absolutely right. Dean, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast.
You've been listening to the Infotainment podcast, focused on the work of the Joint Select Committee on the Draft Online Safety Bill. The podcast was hosted by me, Damien Collins, and produced by David Dargahi.
Thank you for listening, and join us again next time.